Okay, any questions? Any questions, people?
Yeah, where do you stand on abortion, or where does Buddhism stand?
Well, let's analyze it, shall we? Let's analyze it. Let's do the logic. Okay, so a person, life begins for the Buddha at this view, from this view, at the time of conception. Now, there's an extra piece. Now, this is, I'm sorry again, this is too much information, but it's a really good example to show the Buddha's view when life begins. It starts when the egg and sperm come together. That second is when consciousness enters into it. Well, I remember when I got pregnant, that was the time I was in London, and I was a hippie, and there's not too much information here, I won't tell you, because that's when I had an abortion. But I knew that second with this boy, I knew that second. It was like that second I knew I was pregnant. And even that, many women say that. A friend of mine, she said her daughter was staying with her she and her husband were having their house fixed. And the daughter came down for breakfast. Oh, Mum, I'm pregnant. When did you find out? Oh, 45 minutes ago. Many women say that. And that's when consciousness goes in. So that's the beginning of a person. That's the beginning of a human being. A live consciousness from a past life entered into my egg and sperm due to karma. I went with this boy. That time came. The egg and sperm came together. The consciousness went in. And then, so abortion is a human being, basically. So it's called killing. Clearly, it doesn't suffer as much as a 12-week-old fetus. As if it were a fully grown baby. So negative karma, you know, the karma we create is the main factor that determines that in my case it was a negative action was because it was a living being, a human, and I decided I'm going to have an abortion. And I didn't hate it. You don't hate babies. I just didn't want one. So it was attachment. It was very clear. Very simple. It was attachment. I didn't want a baby. So I was suiting my needs, you know, I didn't want a baby. So it's a negative action from that perspective. But the way my baby, in fact, did get harmed terribly. They didn't do the DNC properly, they had to have another DNC. They mangled it. So that's heavy duty. So depending on the way that the being suffers, your motivation, a whole bunch of conditions determine the level of the action. It's a kind of very dependent thing, you know. But that's theoretically the idea. You know, thinking that. I mean, harming a sentient being is called a negative action. So, of course, for your own sake, you don't want to do it, and then you don't want to do it for... I don't want to be mangled in a womb again, thank you very much, by a pair of forces, especially if it was on this place I went to, but it wasn't that one. I went to the National Health. Anyway, any questions, people, about anything at all? Anything you'd like to ask me? Anything you've learned from the last session about the mind?
I don't think there is an answer, probably. There probably is an answer.
Well, I'm smarty pants, I'll probably have an answer. Well, what's the question?
I find it quite challenging to hold certain concepts, and I have to balance how much awareness I pay to it, or it goes too far to too
much. So give me an example. Buddhist concept.
Yes.
Okay, so which one?
One example would be today I'll die, and the other one would be...
To be what time?
Today will be the day I die. That's the first one. To hold that
To think
concept,
that idea, and why would you... Okay, good, let's analyse that. Don't go to the next one.
Okay.
So why... Would you want to think? First of all, let's analyse. Why would you want to think that thought?
I want to think it so that I practice more and I control myself so that I'm not creating more negative karma. So
for your own sake?
Yeah, for my own sake.
So what you're saying is it's hard to know, to believe it's true.
Oh, no, I believe it's true.
No, but it's hard to feel it's true.
It's hard to...
Well, of course it's hard to... Because we don't know that...
To hold it.
Yeah, because we don't know... We don't... Because it's too much for our poor little mind,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes.
That's right.
That's quite challenging.
So maybe if you're on the, you know, I always remember reading about those people on the 110th floor of that building in New York, you know, and they're on the mobile to their wife while the building is collapsing. Then you've really got to confront it then and kind of,
yes,
there it is for you. You're going to jump out the window or die, burn alive, you know. So somehow then it comes home, doesn't it? So then you just, it's okay, just use it, learn, use it. Hold it, you mean you don't want to think it. Because you mean if you really do it, you'll believe it.
No, it's...
But then why is that scary?
It's more distress. So
why
the
then?
More strongly I hold it, there's distress. So like,
but what do you mean by that? Analyze. What do you mean, darling?
So I'm holding it now, and it's difficult not to cry, to be distressed.
Because why? Because you're going to miss your husband and miss the children and miss out on all the things you're going to lose. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not entirely sure why.
Well, that's what you should work at.
It.
Look. Well, no, that's good. But feeling is not enough. And basically, surely it's that. Because the other learning from it is to a wake-up call to make you to even practice and have more love for your husband and more children.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's true that you could die today, and it's true that they could die today.
And it does.
And you see enough examples of it. So that's attachment talking. Just to analyse, you only need distress if it's attachment. If it's compassion and action, you wouldn't be distressed. You'd be energised. So that's okay. So you're seeing your mind. But you have to label it for what it is. is attachment. Whenever, so it's clear, when you understand attachment and aversion, they're so simple it's embarrassing. Attachment's always there wanting the nice things. And the second it even thinks about the unnice things, you have, as you call it, distress. It's called aversion, darling. Can you see?
Yeah.
Very simple. Don't just, it's not enough to say, I feel it. We have to articulate so you can identify the problem. It's very precise. Do you understand?
Yeah.
That's called control attachment. Join the universe. It's okay. Welcome to the club. Do you understand? But the real point from it is to energize you to just be happy to practice and then make the most of what you've got. Make the most of it. That's the real learning. Make the most of it and be delighted. Yeah. It's interesting. What was the other one?
The other one is thinking about the harm that I've caused to other people from my negative actions, and then acknowledging how much of that there must actually be from beginningless time, and the suffering I've experienced, I've done that to other people, and that's distressing as well.
So distressing, try and be a bit more analytical now that you're talking about it. Try and, in the end of this conversation, try and make it productive. So distressing is, we get it. Now be, try and be productive, try and make it something useful for yourself in your own thinking, try and make it useful thinking, seeing as you're going to think about it.
Yeah. So I think to myself that it's a push to have even more control over what I do and say and try to watch my mind so that I'm not...
And that's a decision you make.
Yeah.
And that's an optimistic decision that you want to do that based on compassion. That's good, isn't it? That's not distressing, is it?
Well, I'm quite emotional and extreme, so it's like it's painful thinking about it.
That could be called, that's compassion probably. Yeah. That's good.
And it's trying to hold that and balance it without kind of it going too far that you're just ridiculous, basically.
That's
you're
right.
Too far.
Well, yeah. So that's, but no, but another way to put it maybe is to try to get a virtuous, positive, productive conclusion from it and not an emotional, neurotic one.
Yeah.
That's the other way to put it. You've either got delusions or you have virtues. And this is why this model is so simple, it's almost too simple for us. If it's distress, it's called a delusion.
Yeah.
If it's virtuous and optimistic, it's called positive. So we've got to, and so if it's distress, and you say hold it and not go too far, you mean not make it neurotic.
Yes.
Which is attachment and absurd and going berserk.
Yes.
Absolutely. So make it, you try to capture a positive conclusion.
Yeah.
You try to bring an optimistic conclusion, and that's where you have to learn to work with your mind, isn't it? Exactly.
Yeah.
Good. All right. What else, people? Anything? Yeah, dinner time anyway. Anything else?
Just hearing what Ayla's saying.
Either, it's fine.
Where does forgiveness fit in that? Because what I'm
of herself.
Yeah.
You mean of herself?
Yeah.
Well, like
in
we were saying. I think, like we were saying. You mean? Oh, sorry. Go on. Say it again.
Well, just that forgiveness of herself in this life, in previous lives.
Yes.
So
okay, see, that's, I know, I understand. So that's where, you see, again, these steps somehow, you know. The main point you were making was the harm you've done and the harm you've done to others. So it's coming, it's about the harm you caused to others. But you didn't say the harm you caused yourself, which is the first step.
Oh,
I'm not saying you didn't have
implied,
it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you didn't have it, but that's also there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sick of the mistakes, you're sick of the problems, you're sick of the suffering.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what I'm trying to say here, Karen. This attitude of acknowledging the things that I like, and that's why I keep using the example of nutrition. It's just an analogy, isn't it? It's only an analogy, but it's one we get and understand, and we're very reasonable when it comes to nutrition. We go to the nutritionist, we really want to get better health because we're sick of the suffering, aren't we? Well, that's all we're talking here, but we're talking about mental things. So we understand, when we realize, and she points out, Robina, it's the sugar you're eating, it's the this, it's the that, it's the this. And the first one is, God, what a fool, I can't believe I didn't realize the things. Look what the harm I'm doing to myself. So as soon as you say that, and you own it, it's kindness to yourself, wouldn't you agree? It's kindness to yourself. So almost automatic, that's forgiveness for yourself. But if you beat yourself up, I'm a bad person, ate all that sugar, whack, whack, I shouldn't have done it, that's neurotic. But as soon as you, oh God, what a fool I was. That's like forgiveness for yourself, and it's compassion for yourself. So it's implied if you have that view. And that's why that one's first important to have. When you have it for yourself, when you see the harm it causes you. Because this is the point, you see. If you do have the view of karma, the victim of this life is the oppressor of the past life. And if you can try and imagine that, and you imagine yourself next life being the person who is now abused in turn, then you really have compassion, you know, for yourself, because you realise you're causing that. So, of course, that if you don't have the view of karma, that's a bit abstract, Karen, isn't it? That's clear. But if that is a view that you take as real, then it can have a very powerful effect on your mind. Pardon?
That makes sense.
Yeah. In just the same way, I mean, this way, in immediate ones, immediate things, if I'm fighting with Tony, I know the second I shout at him, he's going to shout right back. And I know I can't bear it, but when the victim one says, well, it's not fair, no, how dare you shout at me, but you just shouted at me, Rabina. You know, so it's like when you really see the pain that's caused when I shout and trigger his shouting, I know it's painful to be shouted at. So if we could really learn that, well, then I better stop shouting at Tony so he doesn't shout at me. But we don't like to think that. I keep thinking I'm allowed to shout at him and it's all his fault. So we can never own it. We can never own it. But when we realise the harm that our shouting does, even in the fact that, even in the sense that it's triggering his anger, you know, then you'd be quiet. But that's why it takes a while to not be a victim. Victim is just the nature of ego grasping. Victim is how we are, you know. It's kind of tragic. It's very fascinating. There's another, more stories about me, I'm sorry. But when I was a radical feminist, a radical lesbian separatist feminist, in London. I came as sort of a hippie, and I turned into a communist, and I turned into sort of supporting the Black Panthers and the Soledad Brothers in London. Then I became a feminist and a radical feminist and a radical lesbian feminist and a radical lesbian separatist feminist. Anyway, when I was that, living in London, I remember we lived in Haringey. And I just had this policy. I don't know why women don't do it now. I mean, all the Me Too women are being a bit weak, I think. I'm not being rude. But I remember I had a policy. I just decided. Any man who ever said anything on the street, I was trying to talk about being raped or anything, but said something to me on the street about my breasts, you know, and I had a nice breast. I'm sure I had a pleasant-looking chest. And men would just say things. Of course they did. You could get arrested in those days. So I remember my policy was, any man who ever said anything to me on the street, I'd walk up to him and very loudly shout at him, punch him, either in his face or in other parts. I did. I just thought it was my policy. I thought, well, if they do it to me, I'm going to do it back and I'm going to embarrass them. And all men were mostly embarrassed and mortified and never said a word and were completely ashamed. But one fellow in Haringey did it back. He chased me down the street. It was in this Greek section. And all the Greek blokes probably thought I was his wife or something. And he was very tall and his fish and chips went flying. I remember that. So I punched him in the face, you know. And he got mad and he's chasing me down the street. And he hit me back. My earrings broke, my glasses broke. But it was so fascinating. I really respected the man. He was the first person who fought me back. I really respected him. I didn't feel upset at all. Imagine if I started moaning and shouting, all these blokes drinking their ouzo, looking at me being punched, and realised I punched him first. Oh, look at that fellow, he punched me. I was really respectful to the fellow. I thought, well done, you know. I didn't have any problem at all. I quite respected him. He was very brave. He was the first one to do it. The only one, actually. Then I gave up, I think, punching men in the nose. I don't know what today's going on. You're making me confess to everything. But another thing about attachment. This is about attachment. It's so fascinating. This other example of something that happened. This is when attachment completely blames the external. You know, like, an attachment is what runs us primordially deep. It's the craving, the junkie in us. It's a symptom of a very suffering person. It's a symptom of a lonely, bereft, nothing person. This is the way to put it. Meaning you're so feeling empty, you so feel dissatisfied, you feel so dissatisfied, so empty, so nothing, that you never stop looking for something out there to fill you up. That's attachment. We can see it in a radical way when it's extreme, like alcohol, food, junkie, sex. But it's just, most of it is just at a low level, you know. So attachment, like you just think of simple attachment to a cake. When you're hungry and the mind is, you know, all excited, anticipating the cake, imagining getting the cake, waiting for the cake, you can't believe it. It's like, this is attachment, we talked about this yesterday. There's this huge panic-stricken anticipation of it. And the panic that you mightn't get. So it's this kind of ravenous. And what you do is you see the cake, and in a sense you're blaming the cake. Look at that delicious cake vibrating such deliciousness at me, just kind of begging me to eat it. What choice do I have, you know? That's the feeling of attachment, isn't it? Like you just completely have no choice. You've got to just shove it in, you know. And I remember, again, another example, a man in the street. This is in Soho. I'm being sort of nationalistic here. There were Greeks and one black. Now this fellow's an Italian. What can I do, you know? Never mind, I don't mean to be racist or anything. But it happens to be so, and he's this old Italian man. He was probably 40. But he looked old to me then. And this is so, it blew my mind. I mean, I didn't know this then. I wasn't a Buddhist, but I've learned from it since. So then he says something about my breasts. You know, and so I shouted at him, and he nearly burst into tears. And he said, "If you don't want me to say something, why do you look like that?" So that's, forget the sexism. This is exactly what attachment thinks. You know, if it's like you're blaming the cake. How dare it look so delicious? I don't have a choice. That's attachment. It completely is this victim, and you just go onto it, you know? That's attachment. Look at the neediness of attachment. You can't say no to the object. So that's, you know, and again, using a more brutal example, remember that time in India on that bus? Remember that woman? Raped with pipes and everything. Yeah. And this boy, this one woman, a journalist, did like an investigation to it and managed to get an interview with him. I don't know if you saw that. It was mind-boggling. This nice Indian boy, a young man, you know. He's in his own culture. He doesn't understand attachment. He doesn't understand his own sexist, you know, environment. I mean, it's pretty intense there, the patriarchy. Do you understand? He doesn't have any sense. He was like naive. And he said straightforwardly in a very innocent way, which everybody thought was a monster, but you understand it. It's his culture. He said, "Well, she deserved it. Why was she on a bus on her own? What does she expect?" That's what attachment and anger think. That, in other words, we so objectify the object and we see ourselves as this innocent victim. And because that's the culture he lives in, and that's the, and you can think of karmically, that's the heavy karma of male-female in India. I mean, they even still probably in some towns chuck the live wife on the bloody funeral pyre. But if you forget the sexist part, forget the female-male part, that's the way delusions work. They dump everything onto the object. So this is what practice is. As you lessen the delusions, it's like you're becoming a whole person. And as you get less attached and less angry, the world has less power for you. Are you hearing that? It's so mature. You become a grown-up and you become in charge of yourself and you don't blame the objects. The very nature of having attachment and anger is a victim mentality in its nature. That's the nightmare of our mental suffering. This is me putting Buddhist, our words onto Buddhist psychology. So as you progress and lessen delusions, you become this profoundly content, fulfilled, joyful, unneurotic, content, fully developed human being. We can hear these words. That's the Buddhist approach. I'm using our words for it. You can't read those words in Buddhist thing. It's like that. Attachment and anger and anxiety and jealous, they're the symptoms of a demented, disconnected, suffering human being. That's what Buddha says. The whole universe is like this, to one degree or another. And that's the interesting point when you study Buddha psychology. There's no discussion of what anyone did to you. It's the mind. It's such a huge holistic system. I can't tell you. And this is from these Indians. 3,000 years ago, they're the ones who mapped the mind. So the knowledge of your mind goes to such a level of subtlety in Buddhism. It is mind-boggling. This is the work to do. This is the job of being a Buddhist. And the thing is, Buddha didn't invent this. He's not an owner of it. He's not a creator. He's just good at it. He's an expert at it. He's like a good botanist. He's got it down, you know. But here we are in a world that is literally the opposite view. So it's quite hard. It's like you're trying to play tennis and you live around basketball players. It's quite difficult. So we should be patient and humble with ourselves. And persevere, you know. And this is why, given that we're driven by this neediness and attachment and not aware of it, and therefore all the other dramas that come, the first level of practice, just like going to AA, you give up the object. The very first level of practice at junior school really is the retreat mode, and the best way to do it is give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll and go to the mountains. You'll really make a lot of progress. But 99% of us won't do that, you know, because it's quite difficult. Even just to be ready. This is what I'm going to read you from. I'm going to read Lama. Now I'll make you happy now and so tell you nice things. Enough of my morbid stories. When you begin to discover the nature of your mind, you know. Yogis. I'll just read you a little bit about how you'll be when you've got single point of concentration. It'll make you excited. Okay. Can't find it. Okay. Here we go. So, okay, this single point of concentration, this technique the Hindus developed more than 3,000 years ago, is this incredibly, and I mean these words very consciously, sophisticated skill to get concentration, which implies not berserk. Complete control, effortless control over all the conceptuality, and as your mind gets more subtle, more subtle, you even give up the sensory. You get to a point of consciousness that's beyond conceptual and beyond sensory. So, of course, that's just mystical to us. We don't posit such a level, but this is what we're talking here. And at that level, the best we can do is imagine it. We can't really think about it because it's not our model. But that's when your mind is much more subtle, therefore completely subdued. And like I said before, I think I mentioned Venerable René, didn't I? And I mentioned he just got to the fifth of the nine stages. I said that. His mind was totally blissful. When the mind is subtle and calm and clear and bright and sharp and powerful and happens to be also blissful. Because conceptuality has at least temporarily ceased, and this, even the senses. So that's not a level of consciousness we posit. And occasionally we might have people have experiences of this, but don't know where it comes from or why or how to get it again, you know. And the point is, of course, you don't do single point of concentration to get the bliss. It's like a bonus. The reason, the only reason for the Buddha that you want to get this laser-like subtle focus is so that you can use it in the second mode of meditation, insight, and easily get insight into emptiness, finally. So this meditation technique is called, in English, Sanskrit, shamatha. In Tibetan, shine. In English, calm abiding. And it's broadly speaking what people vaguely mean by mindfulness, although people are making up their own stuff, and that's fine. But don't confuse it with Buddhist meditation, you know. So as I mentioned, to achieve the realization of Mahamudra, which really just means emptiness, then the reality of non-duality, we first need to develop calm abiding. In fact, it's not possible without it. We must achieve the subtler levels of consciousness of indestructible, one-pointed concentration. So when you've really got that, then they call it samadhi, and that's what the Hindus would have called liberation. The mind's so subtle, so radiant, so blissful, and they said that was samadhi, that's the end result. Liberation, not for the Buddha. He says, you've got to go further. There's still some semblance of mistake there. This sense of an impermanent, inherent self is still there. That has to be annihilated. It's difficult to realize non-duality, not because it's hiding from us, but because our concepts are so thick. So we must refine our concepts. We must achieve subtle mindfulness, subtle awareness, and subtle clarity. Otherwise, there's no way we can see the unconscious levels of ego grasping an independent self. Not possible. Samadhi is the source of liberation. Without perfect samadhi, then, there is no way to become liberated from samsara. No way to achieve enlightenment. There is no exception, whether we're Christians, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist. To cut the dualistic view, we need calm abiding. But calm abiding is not enough. On the other hand, some people actually think that this state of samadhi, this one-pointed concentration, is all we need in order to cut ego. But that is wrong. Lama Tsongkhapa reminds us that calm abiding alone is not enough to cut the dualistic view. We also need to develop special insight, or vipassana, in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, we call it lakthong, lak meaning extra, and tong meaning seeing. We can interpret this to mean that we go beyond seeing conventional reality and achieve the extra seeing of the universal reality of Mahamudra. So Buddha taught many techniques of vipassana. So the one that's known popularly in the world is from the Theravadin level, is from the junior school, high school level, the sutra teachings, not the Mahayana, I mean. And it's where you learn on the basis of concentration in the first mode, you go to the second mode, and then you use that focused mind to pay attention, to get insight into the different sensations of your body, to pay attention to the sensations. And the insight Buddha wants you to get is that is impermanence. But one sort of forget that. We think it's sort of insight into the sensations of the body. No, you're using the sensations of the body so that you can realize things change. So he wants us to get insight into impermanence. This technique is insight into emptiness. It's more advanced. There's many insight meditations. In fact, we have to get insight into everything. Insight into impermanence. Insight into karma. Insight into emptiness. Insight into compassion. This is it's a way of using these two modes of meditation. Yes, Louise.
Sorry, just a quick one. Insight.
Yeah.
Is that another word for, would we use kind of analysis?
No, insight. No. Insight is literally the word that conveys itself beautifully. Inner seeing. It's like an experience of the truth of something. The technique, so are you implying here the Lam Rim approach? Are you discussing that or not? That you use analysis to get it? So what are you implying? Why do you say
I'm
analysis?
I'm thinking, you know, the single-pointed concentration and insight, is that more an experiential thing, or getting that kind of level of concentration to do the work of unpicking.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's literally what it is.
Analyze emptiness.
Yeah, no. Okay, there's a bunch of things in that. Okay. It's actually very simple, but we put these confused meanings onto these words. Okay. Concentration is the preparation where you train your mind to be focused. It happens to have lots of wonderful byproducts, which we're going to read about. You with me? But the purpose of it is to get this laser-like focus. And very simply, why you need laser-like focus is because in the second mode of meditation, we need to use various techniques of using that skillful mind in order to trigger the insight into the truth of something. Insight is the end result. So it's very simple. I use a simple example. We don't talk this way in our world, but we actually do this all the time. I always use a simple example. You go to school and your teacher tells you that 1 + 1 = 2. So that's conceptual first, isn't it? You've never heard of it before. So she says, go home and do your homework, Louise. Now, if she's being a Buddhist, and I'm just joking here, but you listen to it. She'd say, go home, close the door, get some focus first. You need focus, don't you? If you're scattered, how can you do any homework? She wants you to be focused first. And then she'll say, now go to the second mode, and I want you to get some insight into this. What she means is she wants you to get the realization of the answer that 1 + 1 = 2, doesn't she? She wants you, and the insight's the end result. But what's the method you use to get insight? It's very simple. What's the method you use?
Analysis of it.
Right. You think about it, don't you? You don't just go, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2. When we think about analytical meditation, the term they use in Tibetan, we get so confused. And we think we've got to have concentration, and now I'll go to the analysis, and I go, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2. Or, oh, there's no I, or everything's impermanent. That's not a thinking, that's stupidity. You use your noggin in an intelligent way. That's how we learn everything, would you agree? That's how we do sums, how we learn music, how we learn math. You think it through coherently, don't you? And what's the result of that thinking? That's it. Oh, mummy, I got it. The penny drops. That's insight. The technique you use is thinking. And analytical meditation is the term in Tibetan Buddhism. But we get thrown by that, because even the word meditation, we get thrown. The term in Tibetan for the verb to meditate is the verb to familiarize yourself with it. It's a big shock to us. So analysis is a fancy word for to think about. So the first mode of meditation, you've got to get some focus. to whatever degree you've got it. To that degree, you then go to the second mode, and now you open your eyes and you do the analysis on dependent arising, on impermanence, on death. You think through the things you just heard in class, and you think it through in a quiet way with some focus, but intelligently think it through, and at some point it will trigger a feeling for it. That's the insight, and you hold it there. You focus on just that. It will last maybe a second. Like Karen said, you suddenly get a feeling of it. But it goes. So you do the same in your meditation, back and forth. You go back to your focus. You get some focus again. Then you go to the second mode and you do the analysis. So the deeper your concentration, the more sophisticated your analysis from all the teachings you've had, the more subtle, the more deep, the more long-lasting the insight, until eventually you have it can last for days. You're in a subtle, single-pointed focus on the actual experience of emptiness or whatever it might be. Do you understand? So the method you use is thinking. The result is the insight. Do you understand? We learn everything like that. We don't give it fancy names like this. I mean, they make it all mystical, you know. Okay, so in other words, we need the two kinds of meditation together. Calm abiding and the other one they call special insight. So the benefits of samadhi are incredible. Nevertheless, even without special insight, the results of samadhi, it's dinner. I'll just read you a couple of things to get excited. Is Ray out there waiting for us?
Oh, well, he's just done the gong, yes.
Okay. Do you want to tell him we'll be 5 minutes?
Yes.
Just tell him. We'll be five. We're just reading out something I want people to know before they have dinner. 7 minutes. Nevertheless, even without special insight, the results of samadhi alone are unbelievable, almost unimaginable. When we understand this, when we realize how amazing the results are, we cannot help but try to develop it. There's no way we become lazy. We will have much energy and make great effort. We won't even worry about eating. Ha, ha, ha. I will explain some of the benefits. I want Cherry to come and listen to it now, Chester. So, okay, a few examples of some of the benefits of single-pointed concentration. You go beyond sensory and conceptual consciousness. So as your concentration develops, you will go beyond your body. Your mind will be non-conceptual. So it becomes easy to cut the complex world of the five sense objects, to eliminate the superstitions. That's a good word often Lama uses, and they use it for all the dualistic rubbish and the nonsense, all the chat, chat, chat. In such a unified state, your mind becomes so subtle, so sharp, you can easily eradicate the complex dualistic thoughts. You can touch reality. This is the feature of samadhi. And out of meditation, you can easily deal with your delusions. They are so light. You can stop them immediately. That's what's pretty astonishing. Right now, we can see that our mind is utterly, literally uncontrolled. We can't possibly stop thoughts because it would just have it, that's it. So you can imagine having effortless control over every thought. There's no equivalent at all in our culture. Just weird people might be able to do this, but I don't know why, you know. So you experience bliss. So in the subtle state of concentration, you experience bliss, ecstatic bliss, just naturally. The more concentration you have, the more integrated you are, and thus the more rapture, the more bliss you experience. Lama was amazing with words. He found words. I don't know, he was just born a hippie, I think. He just somehow knew words. He was astonishing. When you hear him, and especially in the 70s when he talked, it was like he couldn't understand what he was saying. He had no verbs. He had no structure. He just had all these words. He strung them together. He had no worry what people thought. He was amazing. He was extraordinary. In the beginning, the bliss you experience is physical, which is the grosser level. But as your concentration deepens, as you throw off the layers of blankets of grosser consciousness, you experience bliss exclusively at the mental level. This is because you've stopped perceiving the objects of the five senses. You have closed the door to superstition. All the contradictory concepts have disappeared. Your mind is now crystal clear. As if you could count every atom. As your concentration gets stronger and you reach ever subtler levels, your mind becomes super powerful. From his own experience, Lama Jesongkhapa says that you can reach a point of such clarity in your meditation that your mind feels almost infinite. Your mind is so clear, so sharp, it's as if you can distinguish all the subtle physical energies. You'll have the courageous thought, I can count all the atoms of the universe. This level is more powerful than even scientific instruments. And he means it quite literally, you know. You'll have an experience of, forget that one, you'll always be joyful. When you arise from your meditation, you'll feel liberated instead of uncertain and full of doubts and conflicts. You experience inner peace. You'll always have a happy, joyful vibration. In fact, you continuously experience tremendous pleasure. Now the pleasure of chocolate is nothing to you. What you can now experience with your mind is super. It's like another realm, another dimension. And when your senses do come into contact with their objects, of course, you experience bliss then too. You hardly even notice whether it's day or night. Actually, even now, when you have samsaric happiness, you have a similar kind of experience. You dance and drink all night, intoxicated with the pleasure. Time just flies. Well, this is what happens when you're intoxicated with the blissful experience of samadhi. And of course, this shows that time is not fixed on the outside. It's made up of the mind. But the point is, you're peaceful. You're not hysterical, like we are when we get happy. Even just a glass of water when you're thirsty makes you hysterical. Your body feels so light. When you are out of meditation, the heavy energy of your body vanishes. Your body feels like a brand new body. You feel so light, almost as if you could fly, almost as if you had no body at all. They call it, you get this particular level of incredible mental and physical pliancy, they call it. It's as like you don't have a body. I mean, look at our body is so enormous for us, isn't it? Even a skinny body. We're so aware of it, you know. Your sleep is like meditation. Better go out for Ray. I'll tell you some more. That's a few. That's enough. Tell you some more things. You'll be later. I'll tell you later. Okay. That's the potential of our mind. And what kind of mind is that? A mind that can give up attachment, give up anger, give up anxiety, give up blaming, give up victim, give up depression. Knowing we can do it. And the way to do it is by paying attention and own it. Until then, nothing much changes. And that's the job of being a Buddhist. Then we can be kind and compassionate. Easy peasy, falling off a log easy. You have so much compassion, you won't believe it. And you'll be as solid as a rock and won't be emotional and neurotic. You won't get distressed. You get more brave, more courageous, more wishing to help. You'll be perky and happy. Okay? Have some dinner. See you all later. But tomorrow's our last day, isn't it? We better hurry. We better hurry and finish. I don't quite know if we have to finish yet, but we'll see what happens. Okay. Thank you, people.
Thank you.
See, your dinner is blissful now. See, it is blissful, and get even more bliss when you eat it.
And offer to us.